Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Dr. Nick Begich, the author with Gene Manning of Angels Don't Play This Harp, published in softcover by the Earth Pulse Press, copyright 1995. Dr. Begich, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
It's good to be back with you.
In this interview and in three others that we've recorded over the last year and a half or so, Dr. Begich, we've talked about Project Harp, the projected revolution in military affairs, as it would certainly appear to be. Although Project Censored, which deals with the 10 most important censored news stories of the year each year, listed Project HARP as one of the most important censored stories, sadly, your work has been largely overlooked by the mainstream and even so-called alternative press in the U.S.
You know, it's been reported, you know, occasionally, but it's not gotten the kind of coverage we had hoped it would get in the U.S., although, you know, maybe that will change. At least we're hopeful that it will. And the thing I think that's been the most startling, at least from the military's perspective and ours, is that it has at least maintained some level of visibility over the last 3 years. And in Europe, it's actually getting quite a bit of visibility. We've had one legislative hearing in Europe. We've been invited to a number of forums in Europe to present on the issue. And it is getting some pretty good coverage throughout Europe. BBC TV's picked it up.
The BBC has picked this up.
Yeah, in fact, they did a one-hour special on HARP, which aired not just in Great Britain, but aired throughout Europe, and actually ended up being played in 60 other countries. There also was coverage by Spiegel TV, which is the largest television in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and Der Spiegel magazine, which is one of the more popular news reporting organizations.
It's a major German news organ.
Right, that's right. And, you know, we've gotten, you know, good coverage in even as obscure European countries as Denmark and in Finland, and we've gotten coverage, some coverage actually in Spain as well. And, you know, the issue has emerged there, I think. Maybe it's the idea that Europeans tend to be a little bit more environmentally sensitive in the sense that they're packed in a little closer together and see the consequences of operating systems without much consideration for the next generation. And so there is consideration, I think, being given the project there, and also the wider implications of non-lethal technologies as they apply to HARP and as they stand, you know, separate from HARP in terms of new science.
I think that the educational and journalistic establishments in Europe are more sophisticated than they are here. And one of the things that I think is different from in the European and American consciousnesses is that that people in Europe understand that political work is part of how you care for your personal environment. You don't just go to work and brush and floss your teeth and eat right and exercise. Engaging in political activity is part of how you take care of yourself, and Americans don't realize that. So it is, on the one hand, not surprising to me and also gratifying that in Europe, at least, your work, which I frankly regard as monumental and heroic, and I don't hand out compliments easy, is getting the kind of attention that it deserves. You mentioned BBC, you mentioned Der Spiegel, you mentioned a number of European countries in which Project HARP has been covered journalistically. You mentioned, too, Dr. Begich, that there was a political forum in which there was interest expressed in HARP, and I believe
right.
That was the European Parliament.
Right. We were. We've actually made in the last 2.5 years now 8 trips to Europe, and in the course of that, we established a very good working relationship with the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Department or the committee of the European Parliament. And what Tom Spencer was able to arrange for us was a couple of things: a hearing last year in front of a group representing 40 different countries, parliamentarians on environmental issues, and that sort of opened this issue up. And then again in February this year, we were invited to the Security and Disarmament Subcommittee to give testimony and some meetings in advance of that actual hearing to provide information on HARP and non-lethal weapon systems. And it was an excellent hearing. In fact, it will be part of what will eventually be the Thorne Report on the Environment. And it was the first hearing in a series on the environment and some of the things that we're doing that are not. That are not getting the kind of attention they deserve, that ought to get the attention and ought to get some rethinking in terms of policy.
Tom Spencer is who, Dr. Begich?
He's a foreign affairs chairman. He's a conservative from Great Britain. And it's interesting, as you know, at the same hearing, NATO was invited to attend, and this is the same committee NATO had to go before to get sort of clearance to bring in new member states. And yet when they were invited by the committee, they declined on the basis they said that they had no policy on ionospheric modification, they had no policy on non-lethal weapons. So, you know, we took with us NATO documents from France that are public records and other NATO records that indicate that they have active programs for ionospheric modification and active programs in terms of deploying non-lethal weapons into the battlefield, yet they maintain they have no policy guidelines, which we put to the European Parliament was pretty reckless. And it was their excuse for not coming and engaging in a debate that they rightly should have been at. I mean, we had International Red Cross representatives. We had a physicist, an MD from Canada. We had a weapons specialist from Brussels presenting sort of the other side of non-lethals and these new weapons as they relate to HARF. We even took some things with us to demonstrate, at least on a small scale, what some of these things could do. And, you know, the hearing was great. I mean, parliamentarians are interesting. As we're giving the testimony and providing the information, you could see as we started talking about some of the potential effects of these new and more exotic weapon systems in terms of what they can do to humans. Yeah, I think there is genuine concern there, and I think it's the kind of concern that's going to result in some serious action on the issue, as well as we had the head of the Science and Technology Directorate for the European Commission, someone that reports directly to the president of the European Commission in that hearing, and they are pursuing it. I mean, they're not letting it go. They've got a lot of resources being focused on these new systems, and at the same time, it's starting to pick up some media momentum there as well.
So the European Commission, or at least a key member thereof, is also showing some interest in this.
Yes, and, you know, the thing I found is that, you know, there's two different kinds of people at all different levels. You know, there's people that are really interested in solving problems, and there's others that are there for whatever their own personal agendas and self-interest might dictate. But the interesting thing is that once these kinds of issues are brought forward in credible forums, they do start to take on the right kind of momentum, because there's plenty of documentation to support what we've said, and when people start inquiring to their own scientific and academic communities in reference to that material, they find that that in fact we're right, that there are a lot of things that that really deserve some closer scrutiny at this particular time.
The European Commission, for the members of the listening audience not aware of this, actually wields more power than the European Parliament in terms
Absolutely.
Of the actual administration of affairs in political affairs in Europe. So it sounds from what you've said, Dr. Begic, as though the reception there was generally positive. Can you tell us perhaps a little more about how individuals and or groups of people within the European Parliament and or European Commission responded to what you had to say?
Well, you know, generally, real well. They looked at the issues, they looked at the evidence we brought with us, because we tend to travel around with a library of documents, and we usually leave us that with those kinds of bodies. So, I mean, they were surprised, needless to say, but once, you know, the issue is discussed and they have some sense of it, and they can see where the evidence comes from, which is primarily military documents, there's not a whole lot of discussion about what's possible. It's more of, okay, what rules within the international arena can we apply to these systems? And one of the first things that came up was the issue of the treaties dealing with the Arctic regions, because these systems must operate within those regions to be the most effective, as well as the energy transfers along the magnetic lines of force, which enters those regions. And if people remember, there's a lot of concern right now on the stability of the Antarctic in terms of what's happening with the glaciers. Or you've got chunks breaking off the size of Rhode Island a couple years ago and the size of Connecticut last year, and a big concern that one major rift will slide into the sea and create a rise in tidal height. So the global climate change and then other factors that may impact that change are of significant security interest to Europeans, as they should be to everyone. I mean, climate change, if there's any issue of relevance that's going to affect all of us, this is probably it. And anything that we can do to not accelerate that kind of risk is probably something, and certainly is something that Europeans are keenly aware of and interested in.
Has there been any sort of dialogue between the European Parliament and or individuals associated with it and or the European Commission and governmental and or private officials in this country?
Yes. Actually, Tom Spencer at the end of the hearing sent a letter to Al Gore requesting a specific position on the issue, because after NATO refused to appear, The next place the chairman went was the American Mission in Brussels, who also declined to participate in the hearing. Al Gore was a friend of his and is a friend of his from political work before he became Vice President of the United States. So he made that inquiry. That was about 5 or 6 weeks ago. And now since that time, he has, Tom Spencer has, I know, gone into Washington this week, as a matter of fact, met with the head of the head person who deals with environmental issues in the White House, someone who's seated at the environmental specialist for the National Security Agency as well, and is talking with him about HAARP, and hopefully we'll see some answers at least coming from that direction. And certainly it's a whole different ballgame when it's a political leader from out of the country making the inquiry, more or less, to peers within the country. I think that's a very significant step, and one that we've worked a long time with the cooperation, quite frankly, of radio listeners, because Tom Spencer became aware of our work via talk radio in the U.S. and somebody who knew him sending him some of our material, which got his interest in this issue 2 years ago. So you never know what a person might end up doing with just a little bit of information, and I think that's the role we've started to play in the beginning, and that's the role we continue to play in this debate.
As something of an aside, I regularly exhort my listeners on my home base station to call talk shows. Some do, most don't. I think a lot of people tend to think that that's something which isn't going to bear results, and to a certain extent they may be correct on any given individual phone call, but if people make a habit of that, and if they not only call talk shows on a regular basis, but make their call substantive and informative, in other words, if they take the time to learn about what it is they're going to talk about and make a clear, concise, and relatively articulate point, given the limitations of talk radio and the commercial break clock and everything else they're going to be up against, you never know just what effect some of their actions might have.
That's exactly right. People, people approach me all the time, people I would never expect to listen to some of the radio I've done. And it's amazing what radio people listen to. Everyone listens to talk radio anymore, and everyone finds it not just for entertainment. It's not about entertainment. It's about information, and it's a perspective on the world that, I've met two attorney generals in the last 8 months that both heard me on radio shows that play late at night that I never thought they'd listen to. So you never know who's listening to what, and the thing is, it is the new medium for really communicating. People are looking more and more towards alternative media for the real information, and it's part of what I think is really a revolution in terms of counterbalance to a lot of things we see negative in the world, is the fact that we can communicate via radio, we can communicate via internet now and email and all these things that make the ability of humans to communicate with other humans a lot more efficient and a lot more effective, because it's one-on-one and it's real.
And when that perhaps could be termed an RIA, a revolution in information affairs.
Yeah, it's the balance, because really, if you really want to see a democracy work, it's got to happen by information. And the media has sort of lost sight of that fact, that it's not just freedom. Freedom of the press was right with freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and freedom of assembly, and it was there not to just let you say whatever you want. It was there because the press had a responsibility to maintain those other freedoms of making sure a democratic group of people were educated in the way that the issues are debated. So you used to have lots of media in a given town. You'd have a dozen newspapers all arguing different points of view, but the fact is you had an informed public making informed decisions, and we've lost a lot of that, really, except for the alternatives.
And I think that people should not feel jaded or demoralized, and certainly this stuff is real scary, because there are a lot of interests that go out of their way to make people believe that there's nothing they can do. And the fact of the matter is, as tedious as this will seem to some of my regular listeners, if people call talk shows, use the internet, get up off their expletive deleteds, and sort of commit themselves to becoming nodes of information transfer, to coin a term, they may very well have an effect far beyond, an effect which could be resonant, keeping in the context of some of the Tesla stuff we're talking about.
Yeah.
Their words might resonate far beyond what they might envision.
Exactly. That's exactly what has happened with our work. I mean, it really is the outgrowth of things being simple to do if you just do them. And I think that's really what it's about. I mean, we keep getting invited now to broader forums on various subjects that are somewhat related to our work, and some more so than others. But we're getting an opportunity now to present ideas and problems and maybe solutions in other areas that we think is getting pretty exciting. And I think the fact of the matter is this communications revolution really will generate the opportunity for some serious changes in the way things operate. And I'm an eternal optimist anyway. I mean, I'm accused of being too optimistic, but the fact is, you know, mankind's been faced with other challenges before, and we've overcome them. And the same obstacles facing us today are the same ones that have always historically faced us, which is the allocation of resources and who pays for government services and how much of it do you want. You know, it's really the same battle over and over again.
I think the problem could be phrased that there appear to be more back ends of horses than there are front ends. It has to be dealt with.
That's it.
Nick, you were talking about NATO in connection with your presentation of this material to the European Parliament. One thing I'm not at all clear about is what relationship NATO has as an organization to Project HARP. Certainly the U.S. is a key member of NATO, and this is an American project. I've no doubt that other NATO countries are engaged in research along this, these same lines. What is the relationship, if any, between NATO as an organization and Project HARP as an operational device?
Well, I think from the Europeans' perspective, when they contacted NATO, I mean, they look at NATO as the link in terms of treaties and alliances, in terms of defense. And, you know, because of that link and because of the cooperation between militaries, there's this whole idea that, you know, we ought to all be on the same page if it comes to developing technologies. And certainly policymakers who chair defense subcommittees of groups like the European Parliament ought to be privy to some of that information related to these new technologies, and they're not. And that's when you think about bureaucracies running their own agendas without the appropriate oversight by the political bodies who control their budgets, control their actions, and control when and where they might be used and deployed. Not being informed on what weapon systems might be used and deployed, or certainly which ones are being developed, you know, from a politician's perspective, it's the wrong answer. You know what I mean? To be developing these things and then to come to a committee and say we're not showing up because we don't have a policy, and then that same committee getting the evidence that not only if they don't have a policy, then it's really a response. So they certainly got a program, and program without policy is a bureaucracy running away without proper accountability. And being able to do it without any transparency because of national security laws, which was a major issue in our presentation to European Parliament, was that these national security laws, while they may have served a very vital purpose in the 40s and the 50s, as we progress now into the 90s and now into the next millennium, what has actually happened is a bureaucracy has gotten insulated from being accountable to the public, particularly to politicians. And that is a very dangerous and unwise a direction to be going.
You mentioned that there were other forums, in particular in Europe, that were opening up to your information. You mentioned that you were a participant in a forum dealing with issues vis-a-vis the Black Sea, along with some other very notable people.
Right. I was in a conference, and again, this is sort of the outgrowth of our HARP work, but I got invited to a conference in the Black Sea region that essentially was to look at ways to develop a more vibrant economy without destroying the environment in that region. And what happened then is an outgrowth from that trip last fall, I wrote a paper on sustainable development and some innovative ideas that might be applied to the region. The paper got some attention, so we were invited by Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, and also the Patriarch in Istanbul for the Orthodox Church, to participate it was last week in a week-long seminar on the subject of the environment and poverty and how those two things have become interlinked, and look for solutions that might be regionally usable for regions that might have an interest in changing the directions they're currently in.
You mentioned Robert Kennedy Jr. was also a participant in this conference.
Right, he was one of the other keynote speakers, along with UNESCO and then members of the clergy from the Orthodox and others. It was a well-received group, I mean, essentially across denominational and interfaith lines, but the main message for this conference was dealing with the idea that the environment is innately linked to who we are as human beings, and the fact that all major religious traditions suggest that we're not here to just rape and plunder the planet. We're here to to share in what the planet can produce for us so that we can enjoy improved and great living experiences. And I think that's the idea, that we sort of overrun it in some respects, is the caution. So, and the issue of poverty was the central theme for this conference. And the interesting thing that came up, and I think the conclusion that was at least sort of through everything, was that the best way to address poverty is to let people at a local level start to determine, you know, what thresholds are rational and reasonable. You know, what we think of as poverty in the U.S., if you're living an Aboriginal lifestyle in some other part of the world, you might not see yourself as poor. In fact, you might be enjoying a better lifestyle with a lot less stress than we do in this country. And I think that's sort of in the mix these days, that too much third world development is driven by large corporate interests that have an interest in exploiting what they can and sort of exporting a lifestyle that maybe the people within a region don't really want. You know, maybe they don't want a McDonald's on every corner or a television in every house. Maybe what they have is quite good. So there was a big distinction between what you might call misery and being poor, and the idea that the environment and the place you live can be greatly enhanced by some of the patterns that we follow. And more than that, that in developing regions, there's a lot of traditional knowledge in place about health and healing and agriculture and various things that's being lost as countries develop that ought to be exported, if you will, to the more developed world, while we pay attention and give respect to the lifestyles that they have there and find some ways that we can mutually benefit by each other's interaction, but not destroying culture and what otherwise might be working quite well.
Was there any actual discussion of Project HARP in this context and how it would relate to those issues?
Not in this particular forum, although, you know, every time we get into these forums, we have the opportunity of meeting other players on major issues throughout Europe and throughout the Eastern and Western world. So we're able to dialogue, and a lot of opportunity is given to us to freely dialogue on these subjects. So we've gained a lot of allies. In fact, in many of these forums that we go to now, we're bridging across a few disciplines, we're bridging across some political lines. At the same time, we're being recognized more and more as a source for good information. We just have an incredible reach into good sources of information and provide a lot of data that maybe is making a bit of a difference around the world.
Good. One of the things that strikes me about Project HARP, and that is the potentials for abuse. Obviously, the possible unforeseen side effects are truly chilling and could be devastating. Relating to the whole issue of poverty, obviously there's a lot of attention right now on the Asian financial turmoil,
right,
and what
right.
effect that is likely to have. I think the combination of that and the introduction of the euro, which is certainly going to have a profound effect on the world economy. It remains
Absolutely.
To be determined exactly what that's going to be. There's another major issue that the American media are just ignoring. This is a huge, huge, huge thing, and people are just not paying any attention. But in the event of a worldwide financial collapse and an economic crisis with a lot of people who are hungry, homeless, or whatever, are in want or in need, the potentials of a project like HARP for disposing of large numbers of unwanted people, either abroad or perhaps in the United States, since this can be applied here in the U.S., strikes me as one of the more ominous things on the horizon.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about massive crowd control, certainly this technology is got the potential. I mean, when you're looking at even the subject of crowd control and using these kinds of technologies for that purpose, it shows up throughout Department of Justice and military literature, but never discussed in the context that we're having this conversation now, that it would be on a mass, a very large scale. There's only one reference to that, and it goes back quite a ways, but the fact of the matter is the technology is here. It could be utilized in that way. Would it be utilized in that way? You know, better someone else's words than my own. And I'll quote Zbigniew Brzezinski, who eventually became National Security Advisor to Carter. And back in 71, when he was at Columbia, he made a statement talking about all this new technology in a book called Between Two Ages. And the basic gist of it was, that didn't matter who was in power, liberal or conservative. In fact, these technologies were coming. The temptation to use them by either party would be greater than the good sense to restrain. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of what he was saying. And I think that really speaks to the issue. Unless the public is aware of what's possible and objects to the use of these kind of technologies on a broad basis, both from the grassroots level in the U.S. up and from external governments outside the United States in, which is exactly what we endeavored to do and I think we're beginning to accomplish, that's the only time that that policy will change. Otherwise, you can expect these new systems to be developed and to be deployed both domestically and abroad, and the policy guidelines to allow to do for that are in place. And, you know, we're very careful. I mean, we document everything. I mean, there's good footnoted sources in everything we've written that supports us making that kind of a statement. I think that's why Americans and others around the world are concerned about these issues.
Indeed, they should. It just strikes me if you have, for example, a lot of people in Asia who are hungry and they form a restive political entity, the creation of droughts, floods, and some of the types of things that have been envisioned as outgrowths of Project HARP could be a very good way of, if not outright destroying them, certainly bringing them to their knees and mandating what is known in national security circles as nation building, a massive aid program, which would in fact be directed toward restructuring that society more along the lines that, say, either the United States or someone else might envision.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when we were speaking, as I mentioned, a year ago in May in Brussels to this group of parliamentarians, that's where I became acquainted with the Orthodox. And that person in the audience came up afterwards and said, you know, the speech you just gave is the apocalypse. And I said, well, you know, a lot of people think so. And then we got invited to these various forums. Well, the Orthodox traced their roots to A.D. 95, and it was at that time that John the Revelator had his vision about revelations, and that's sort of the beginning of their whole tradition. But it's interesting is people do see that in Project HARP, and many scientists see that in Project HARP. And the fact of the matter is, maybe we are creating our own apocalypse in the way that we're producing and developing and playing with our technologies, and really for the wrong reasons. I mean, we're developing these systems to develop better kill systems at a time when it's already apparent we can all kill each other in innumerable ways and innumerable times. And maybe it's time to be putting a little bit of our resources into a direction that most people, and not just Americans, but around the world would prefer to go. And it always boils down to the same thing. I mean, it's a few wanting to maintain the control of the many. And I think that's, you can call it a conspiracy, you can call it human nature. But the fact of the matter is, I think most human beings would like to see that change, and I think that goes across boundaries. I mean, if there's any new globalism that's relevant, it's the idea that I can dial in on the phone or a fax or a computer and talk to anybody on the planet and exchange the same basic ideas and feelings of being exploited just by different governments but by the same multinationals, which is a quite interesting phenomenon that's occurred really in our lifetimes more than any other time in history.
Yes, indeed. The world is getting smaller, and I think by that, along those lines, each individual has got to become bigger. We are out of time, Dr. Begich. We've been speaking with Dr. Nick Begich, who, along with Gene Manning, is the co-author of Angels Don't Play This Harp, available in softcover from the Earth Pulse Press, copyright 1995. Dr. Begich, has been a privilege, as always, and we will be back to you to find out the latest developments on HARP.
Thanks very much for having me.
For Dr. Nick Begich, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.